Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Aparuta de sangamatasa tawara e sodavanta bamunjantu satang. So reflections on the way it is. This moment is just like this. And then without any description or attempt to describe it, you just trust your awareness. It's the way it is. It's like this. And it's kind of like I open my arms up and kind of receive the motion, the view and sight, is whatever it is, whether it's pleasant, unpleasant, whether I like it or don't like it. Because this is reality, this is real, this is not pretending or to know anything, like have a specific view or opinion about the way it is. It's letting go of all views and opinions to just open to experiences as we have it in the present moment, because experience is always here and now. The past is a memory, the future is unknown, it's imagined. So these are teachings of the Lord Buddha. They're not, I can't claim them as my teachings, but they're reflections, because it is reality, it's the way it is. But when human beings, we're usually not programmed to appreciate the way it is, to open to it, because we have views and opinions, plans for the future. We can be caught in anger or resentment, remorse, guilt about things of the past, in the present. Or we're planning our next trip, or what we'll do next year. So that's in the future. So with the paticca-samuppada dependent origination, when you start using that as a reference point, as a meditation, the advice I was given to really focus on desire and grasping of desire, that point of dhanha, upadana, in that sequence. Because as we chant that in Pali, avicca bhajaya sankhara, that notice that avicca is ignorance of Dhamma, the way it is. So avicca, as long as we're operating from the way ignorance of the way it is, then the result is always grief, sorrow, despair, and anguish. So this is where reflective meditation, being able to reflect on the way it is, like just the simplicity of opening to the present moment is like this. It doesn't sound like a real, you know, technique, or, you know, we can think, so what, you know, it doesn't resonate with me, because you'd like me to tell you exactly how to reach enlightenment, how to attain stream entry, how to improve your concentration, how to, get something you don't have, some idea you've read in the scriptures, in the suttas or other Buddhist texts about getting samadhi, getting different levels of concentration and jhanas, and being able to communicate, read minds, walk on water, go to the heavenly realms. These are all, you know, imagined and desirable concepts. So they are, you know, like being reborn in the Deva realm sounds pretty good to the ignorant person. To live 84,000 eons in bliss with an ethereal body, you know, that you could elaborate on those words to make them even more exquisite, exotic, and wonderful. But the way it is, at this moment, it's not like a heavenly state or a hellish state. It's just like this. Or if you're caught in anger, then the way it is like this. And so you're kind of open to your emotions rather than resisting them or following them. Clinging to views, creating concepts and clinging to them is suffering, because we all have different views. We don't always agree on issues, ideas, ideals, or what's right and wrong. So we have conflicts with each other because of the attachment to our particular view. It's not that one's view is wrong or it's absolutely right. It is a view, maybe an intelligent one. But to open to the way it is to see this attachment, to begin to notice this clinging to views creates endless problems with others, because unless they share our views, then we tend to argue with them or disparage them in some way. So the world goes on with very righteous views or personal views, personal agendas, personal desires. And that's the reason why, like in family life or work life or political life or monastic life, these personal habits are oftentimes in conflict with someone else's. So it's not that everybody should have the same view as I do, or my view is the best one, but to be the witness to my clinging to the view that I think is absolutely right. It's like this. Clinging to righteous views is like this. And as you sustain your attention, you open to it. You're not trying to create more views about your own view, but just witness the reality of the moment of clinging to a viewpoint. And it's like this. And being the senior monk for so long, you know, had many opportunities to observe this, because I'm, as a person, I had certain views that I felt were right, And then if somebody disagreed with me, I could be quite angry or wanting to argue with them or prove that I'm right and they're wrong. And then listening to that, just watching myself in this tendency to react through my clinging to my own view, I began to see the suffering that I'm experiencing. And I realized I don't want to be like that. I don't want to be a righteous Buddhist monk that forms opinions about everything and then imposes them on others and feels offended or angry when they're not appreciated or somebody resents them. With religion, any religion, one of the big problems is righteous indignation. Because in religious teachings, usually they're saying our view is the right view. And then arguing about God and the existence of God, or are there gods, or is there just one God? Is there monotheism, paganism, polytheism? And God becomes a form of contention, just the word. Because one's clinging to one's personal view of what God is. And it is a view. It's not God. It's just a viewpoint that you are very attached to. And that's upadana, or clinging to a view. And it's like this. And as you investigate in this way, you have the insight to let go. Because it's not peaceful to be right all the time. It isn't a pleasant state of mind to always have to be right. When you really observe it, clinging to it, really, you know, I'd say, really cling to right view and observe it. Hang on to it as long as you can, and then just to see the result of obsessive clinging to a viewpoint, and then I could see how miserable I become. So desire and clinging in the dependent origination, if for those who've never used the teaching, because it does seem complicated, it's about what the Buddha actually, as according to scriptures, was using when he was enlightened, because it's about avijja, ignorance of the way it is, and that the result of that ignorance always ends up in suffering. So in the Paticca Samuppada, dependent origination, then the avijja is ignorance of the Dhamma, the way it is, and then it leads to desires, and then clinging to desires, and the result of that clinging to desires leads to grief, sorrow, despair, and anguish, suffering. Then the Nirodha side of the Paticca Samuppada is where there's right view, vicha, right understanding, and then right understanding is everything falls away. all the suffering, the clinging habits, the resentments, the old conditioning of oneself just disappears. It's nirodha. It's up in silence. So this you can prove to yourself. You know, this isn't a doctrine that you have to believe in, but it's a skillful means to investigate the causes of suffering. So when somebody asked me to teach the pen and origination, it's very simple. Ignorance is the cause of suffering. But then you are able, you know, you can say, Ajahn Sumedho says this and quote me, and that's another viewpoint. Ajahn Sumedho said this, we trust Lungpa Sumedho must be right. But that's not the point. It's to the encouragement to find out for yourself whether I'm right about this, or the Buddha was right about this. And I remember, there are many righteous views about dependent origination, about being a three-life theory, but then when I really started investigating using the Paticca Samuppada, dependent origination, I thought if it's three lives, it's just a theory. It has no value for meditation, because past lives, where are they? You know, I can't remember. I can speculate about my past, what I must have been before I was born in another life, but that's just more thinking, more ideas, because at this moment, here and now, letting go of everything, just opening to the way it is, there's no memory of past lives. There's no person to remember past lives. There's no Lungpa Sumedho. When it's like this, there's no Lungpa Sumedho anymore. So the body's here, and the tradition and custom is to refer to this form sitting, giving this reflection as Lungpa Sumedho giving Dhamma talk. That's convention, but that's also, you know, conditioned phenomena. It's sankharas, conventions are sankharas, are condition, are phenomena. So I remember I think it was Malaysia or Taiwan, somebody published a book called No Ajahn Chah. And you know, so this is, you know, we can cling to Ajahn Chah and said, Ajahn Chah said this, Ajahn Chah said that, or the Buddha said this, the Buddha said that, and then we cling to these very wise teachings. But that's not what they're meant, that's not the way to liberation, just clinging to what somebody says, but to find out for yourself. So the teachings are directional signs pointing to yourself. Instead of quoting Ajahn Chah or suttas, Buddhist texts, or Sufi sages, or, you know, the wise people that you read, these are appreciated, but they are just words. And as long as we cling to the words and quote from others, then we may sound wise, but we still suffer. And we get upset if somebody says, I don't think Lungpo Cha was an arahant. Because as a person, I personally had the view that Lungpo Cha was an arahant. So that was my personal view. And then somebody, one time, some Westerners came to Wat Bapong and they started to criticize Ajahn Chah, and I got very indignant. Felt very righteously indignant and angry. And I said, you're just hippies coming from the United States looking for arahants in Thailand. How do they know what an arahant is? And I thought, you know, I didn't say this, but I felt it and felt very angry and wanted them to go. Because they're criticizing what I regard as an arahant. They're saying he's not. And then I began to witness how I want my teacher to be an arahant. It's like this. It's very personal, very egotistical. You know, this kind of clinging, it might be well-intentioned, might be even right, but it's right and wrong are still views, concepts. Ajahn Chah is, what is Ajahn Chah right now for all of us is a word. Some of us knew him, remember him. Most of you didn't know him, so you have the references to him, and we can say Lungpo Cha was an arahant. But and you might believe, you know, you might very well believe that. But when you investigate, you begin to see that it's clinging to Lungpo Cha was an arahant, but some other monks not an arahant, and who's the best arahant in Thailand, or who says they're an arahant when they're not, and the gossip goes around, viewpoints and opinions, and strong views, and anger arises. Wherein awareness here and now, no matter how righteous you might feel emotionally, and maybe you are absolutely right, it's like this. And then this reminding is like this, is a way of letting go of your attachment to being right. And when the emotions are strong, you have to be patient while the power of that emotion still lingers in your mind. And you sustain that awareness till it actually ceases, and that's Nirodha, the end of suffering. So this non-grasping is still an idea, isn't it? It's a good suggestion, it's a reflection, and we all should let go, we can say. I remember early days at Chitthurst, we would, about watching your mind, when somebody start saying something, you know, we feel upset or angry, we say, watch your mind. So a kind of command, a kind of saying, it's really, you mean shut up, I don't want to hear you. But I say, using the words watch your mind as a way of saying shut up. So it was good advice, but intention was wrong. The time and place was wrong. So the words, the right words, righteous words, wise things can you know, they, we can use them to, for the wrong intentions. So Nirodha is here and now, the third noble truth, or emptiness it's described, or non-attachment. And what does that do, like emptiness, that word, do you want to be empty, not be anybody? You know, is live in an empty world of nothingness? Is that nibbana? You know, when you try to figure out what nibbana really is, or the goal of Buddhist meditation, to realize emptiness. So just thinking to yourself, the word emptiness, you feel like this. It's like this, just intentionally bringing this word into consciousness. And of course the word falls away very quickly, but then it can leave an emotion of, you know, of fear, of falling into a black hole of nothingness, of emptiness. Is nirvana just nobody at all, no person, just empty, blank? And you can't imagine it. You know, trying to imagine nirvana. You know, it sounds, you know, you can make it sound, well, it's blissful. Nirvana is bliss. And that makes it pleasant when you think of nirvana or emptiness. And when you experience emptiness, it's blissful. Then it sounds very attractive, because we like bliss, but not being anybody, lost in a void of nothingness or emptiness, is rather terrifying, frightening. So who is aware of all this? These are words that we can, you know, like, people use words to frighten each other, scare each other, because we're very open to that, say frightening things, suggesting terrible things will happen. And then in the present moment, maybe life is all pleasant and you're happy and everything's going your way, and then somebody says something to scare you, to terrify you. And suddenly all that, you're caught in this sense of terror, fear, just by what somebody might say to you or suggest. So you see how complicated life is on this samsara level, where everything is very either pleasant or painful, right or wrong, good or bad, heaven or hell, true or false. You know, we all, you know, want everything to be good and fair and equal and free and right. We'd like to have bliss, a kind of permanent state of bliss, and because that sounds very pleasant, to spend one's whole lifetime in this form, in the state of absolute bliss. So one seeks bliss or happiness, success, and that's the goal in life for most human beings, is security, stability, wealth, power, all the conditions that we cling to or maybe long to have, or just to be content. I want to be just content with a simple life. But that's still an ideal. So it's a good ideal, but the practice, the bhavana, or meditation, right meditation, isn't about trying to make yourself content, but in observing discontentment, unhappiness, fear. So our suffering is the first noble truth. Because this realm of this, the form, the human form, is a suffering form. You know, how long can you sit and or stand, walk, or lie down? You know, you have to feed it, you have to rest it. It grows old, subject to ailments, diseases. And we'd like to stop that and have plastic surgery to kind of keep the illusion of youth possible, or people long for, you know, to live for hundreds of years. In a, what state would you want to live for 200 years, you know, as just in an old, haggard, wretched human body that's 200 years old, or if they had some magic pill or surgical operation that would make you live in a youthful state for 200 years, that might sound very attractive. And of course, a charlatan would take advantage of ignorant people to promote, you know, snake oil or something that will make us live happily, youthfully, healthy forever. But who is it that wants to live forever in a limited form? Do you personally want to live forever in a male or female form? You know, and when you ask yourself that question, I don't think anybody wants to live forever in such a form as this, as a male or female body. And then the movements now to, like, you should love your body and all kinds of exercises and moving, you know, loving your body, being healthy, happy, successful. But loving your body, who is it that loves their body? And personally, one can love it or like it when it's young and healthy and good looking. But it can't stay that way. You know, these are time-bound conditions. Bodies are born, they grow up, get old, and die. That's their nature. So are you really, you know, I'm asking you to ask yourselves, are you really the body? Is this what you want to identify with? Like with the aging process, like people lose their memories, they get Alzheimer's disease, they can't remember who they are, where they're at. So memory is very ephemeral, you know, it's easily lost. And I remember years ago reading a biography of a president of India, whose name I've completely forgotten. I think it was in the 1950s, and he was a highly educated, learned man, with very, very highly regarded and respected. Had, you know, had all kinds of doctoral degrees. I was going to say disease degrees, and because I'm getting old too, or I am old. But, and then in his old life, he lost all his memory, total memory, all his learning. Forgot everything, it just became an empty form. Is that what we think of as just getting Alzheimer's disease and losing our memory? Because the body still needs to rest and sleep and eat. And the body still functions. So the thinking mind is also very ephemeral. And so it can go with dementia as one ages, losing that ability, but the body still operating. It's like this. So the forgetting, as long as one has a body, then whether you're completely compos mentis or you have dementia or Alzheimer's, the body is like this. It still has needs just to survive. And that's the nature of the body. Are you really this body? Are you really your thoughts and views and opinions? And as you investigate in this way, ask who you really are. You know, then the insight into letting go of sankharas, letting go of conditions. It's not about getting rid of them or destroying them, but just not living a life full of tension, of grasping, hanging on to past memories or future possibilities. So that is silence, because the consciousness itself is magical. When we talk about magic, you know, you can form magical tricks, fooling people or deluding them in some way. But what is truly magic is consciousness itself, because you can't find it, you can't see it, hear it, smell it, taste it, touch it. You can't objectify it in any way. But that's here and now, conscious awareness here and now, the reality of here and now. It's consciousness. We're experiencing all the time the magic of consciousness. And the form that we identify with is manifests in consciousness. And that try to understand that with logic and reason. So is consciousness, you know, it's what religions are about. They're looking for the ultimate reality. So you create images of God or Allah or Krishna or Brahma or Thor or other kinds of ways of trying to realize your true nature by imagining a superpower that created you. So all that is part of the human thinking process and cultural conditioning. But it's an attempt to realize the here and now reality. The magic of conscious awareness is like this. So suddenly the word magic, when you think of, is the earth, the solid element, magical? Is the water magical? Is fire magical? Is air magical? These things come and go and change. You can objectify them. You can see mountains, lakes, trees, men, women. How did they get here? How did they, who created all this phenomena? You know, did the earth element create the phenomena, or did, you know, then God is more kind of obvious way of explaining it. Because, you know, God created everything, so the creation theory is one way of dealing with the problem. Or then when we're very intelligent and rational, we tend to think that all those religions are myths and fairy tales. They're not true because they don't make sense. Logically, you can't prove God. And some people think they can, so they try. And then they have arguments about that. But the reality is the way it is here and now. It's the magic of being aware. It's like this, as simple as that. But your personality may not like what you're hearing because you want to get something. You want the way it is here and now. It's like this. Well, what is it like then? Tell me. You know, because I don't know what you're talking about. Because we're conditioned to think and try to hold on to objects, cling to views and opinions. That's how we're conditioned, culturally conditioned to do that. So, you know, it's encouraging to investigate to find your true nature. Is not a limited form. Caught in a whirlpool of samsara. And as you begin to really understand through wisdom, this is where wisdom can inform you rather than intelligent theories and ideas. So I want to offer this as a reflection for this afternoon.